Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Titanio de Cara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good blah morning, aloha kako, and maloe tau mae pomponginni. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Marianne Kupu, from Nuku'alofa, the capital of the Kingdom of Tonga. Today on the show, as pressure mounts, Vanuatu's president isn't backing down over controversial pardons. Australia has announced an $8 million package to help tackle Fiji's HIV crisis.
Managing a very infectious disease such as HIV requires enormous resourcing and enormous technical and strategic investment.
We've got more story coming up today. I'm your host, Marianne Kupu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Let's start with Vanuatu. Vanuatu's president is refusing to bow to public pressure and revoke the pardons he granted to two men convicted of sexual abusing children. The Prime Minister is among those who have voiced concerns and called on Nikinike Vurubaravu to reconsider his decision. Instead, the President's office released a lengthy statement outlining the factors he takes into account when exercising his constitutional power of mercy. But that has not satisfied his critics, as Lily Rose Wellwell reports.
If President Nikinike Vurubaravu taught a lengthy statement about how he exercises his constitutional power to grant pardons could calm the controversy, it looks like he was wrong.
It's very light. It's very confusing. His statement keeps saying this is his sole decision. But, you know, just because it's your decision, you have the power to do it, you need to use some common sense. There's no mention of the victims.
Dr. Willie Tokon is the CEO of Transparency International Vanuatu and chair of the Vanuatu Association of Non-Government Organizations.
Right now, if you see in the social media, there's a lot of call for him to resign. And I'm not surprised. For an educated person like him and in that position to be acting alone, and now he's trying to justify his decision, but everybody is saying, no, I was not consulted.
The controversy started last month in the lead-up to Independence Day when President Vurubaravu exercised his constitutional power to pardon 13 inmates. Later, it emerged four of those pardoned had been convicted of sexual offences, two of them for the sexual abuse of children. According to the Daily Post newspaper, one still had 6 years to serve of a 10-year jail sentence. The other had 7 years remaining on a 15-year jail term. Jane Yatika, president of the Port Vila City Council of Women, was among those who publicly expressed concern.
Many people feel surprised, worried about the cases, but then it sends out a message to the survivor and the public of where their safety stands.
Prime Minister Chotham Napat says he was deeply concerned by the pardons and he met with the president on Monday to personally ask him to revoke them. Instead, the president's office, State House, released a statement outlining the factors taken into account when exercising the constitutional power of mercy. Among them are serious medical conditions, rehabilitation, family responsibilities, and reintegration into the community. State House said the president also relies on information and supporting documentation such as medical reports and references from chiefs, church leaders and family members. The statement said a pardon does not diminish the seriousness of the offences committed. Jane Yatika disagrees.
Pardoning with years left to serve can feel like the state is choosing mercy for the offender over justice for the victim. that weakens deterrence and confidence.
She agrees rehabilitation is important, but offences involving sexual violence need to be treated carefully.
Everyone deserves a pathway, but for crimes of sexual violence, especially against children, the bar has to be much higher.
The statement from the State House does not refer to any specific cases. Jeniatika believes the president needs to explain clearly why he pardoned the men convicted of sexually abusing children.
Transparency matters. Without published criteria, victim consultation and advice from women, child safety agencies, it looks arbitrary and it erodes trust.
Dr. Willie Tokot from Transparency International Vanuatu says they should only be on situation in which a pardon should be granted.
The only time you can pardon somebody if they have been wrongfully convicted and they have been wrongfully imprisoned, because that is wrong. That's the only case where you can pardon the person.
It's not the first time the president has sparked controversy over granting pardons. Last year, he revoked the pardons he granted to 70 inmates after a public backlash. In its statement, State House acknowledges that greater institutional guidance could assist future presidents and provide greater public understanding and confidence in the process.
That was ABC's Lily Rose Wellwell reporting.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tini Rau Arona.
I think the big thing that's changed, Sammy, is the way you go about it now. 20, 30 years ago, you could be quite direct with a player. And now it's more about trying to guide them to the solution themselves rather than being so blunt.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Australia is stepping up its response to Fiji's growing health crisis with an $8 million package announced this week to help tackle the surge in HIV infections. New cases in Fiji have jumped tenfold since 2014, prompting the Fiji government to declare a national HIV outbreak back in January last year. The new 30-month initiative, called ASFAR, or Australian Support for Pacific HIV Action, will fund community-led testing, treatment and prevention programs and will work alongside local organisations. Reporter Jordan Fennell spoke with Health Equity Matters CEO Dash Heath Painter.
So it's funding a coalition of Australian organisations to deliver comprehensive support to local Fiji organisations and the clinical workforce to address what is really a very serious health threat over in Fiji. And of course, this has been funded by DFAT, so this is a contribution from the Australian government to address a regional health concern.
You visited Fiji a little while ago and you're heading there next week. What have you seen on the ground in terms of this HIV crisis?
Yeah, so Fiji is experiencing a very serious HIV outbreak. It's been declared formally by the government as a very serious health threat. The country has experienced a 3,000% increase in HIV since 2010. And so if you compare that against Australia, of course, very, very different health systems and levels of resourcing. But if you compare that against Australia, we have experienced about a 30 to 40% decline in HIV notifications over the same period. So managing a very infectious disease such as HIV requires enormous resourcing and enormous technical and strategic investment. And Fiji is in need of really significant support from settings that have achieved in addressing HIV in their own settings, such as Australia, and that's what this investment will do.
And what can Australia offer Fiji in this space? What lessons have been learned over the years in terms of how to tackle HIV that you'll be looking to take to Fiji?
Yeah, so Australia, of course, imperfect, but by and large, Australia has achieved very highly in terms of responding to HIV. And we've achieved highly because we deployed very early on in the AIDS crisis in the 1980s a partnership model that saw affected communities working with clinical and research partners and government to respond to this health threat. And so really what you saw was the key institutional parties who needed to support and respond quickly to a health threat moving together, but most importantly with community leadership. What this investment from the Australian government does is it really it allows for Australia to demonstrate its excellence in this field by taking what we have achieved here and working with local Fijian organisations in the context for Health Equity Matters. And there's a national there's a system strengthening stream for this, which is being led by our clinical partners ASHAM and other Australian organisation. We will both be working with local Fijian organisations to build their technical capacity to respond to HIV. And the important thing here to remember is we are deploying the excellence we have so that local organisations can customise that excellence to address the specific needs of HIV in Fiji.
Yeah, you've said that Pacific communities will be at the centre of this. Why is it important in terms of having them centred to be able to lead it on the ground in Fiji as you're coming in to assist?
Yeah, so HIV is a condition that we need to provide an enabling environment for people to feel comfortable to access health services. In order to make people feel comfortable in talking about their health, and of course HIV is a condition that's passed or that is transmitted through a sexual contact or through sharing injecting equipment, we need people to feel comfortable talking about their personal life and their personal health. In order to do that, we need to have communities who are affected by the condition leading the responses, so the responses are customised and culturally sensitive to the communities most affected by HIV. And of course, those communities, in particular people who use drugs, gay and bisexual men, are communities that have a history of being marginalised and or criminalised in many settings around the world. It's really important for any response to be effective that those communities are leading the programs and activities that are being designed to respond to the health threat.
At the end of the 30 months, how will you judge whether this effort has been successful?
Yeah, look, it will be a challenge. I'll make it very clear now, we are not going into this with a view of ending HIV in 30 months. We are really laying the groundwork to address and the foundation to address a very serious health threat. I think from our perspective as the organisation leading engagement with local community organisations, what I would like to see at the end of the 30 months are really robust and sustainable organisations that can independently deliver HIV programming to serve their community's needs, but also organisations that have very strong relations with decision makers in government in Fiji. Because what we really want is to see Fiji lead on responding to this health threat in its own country and to be able to act independently to drive down infections over the course of time. But that's not going to be something that we will see automatically and potentially not at the end of 30 months. This is a health threat that will need ongoing investment for a very long time to bring it under control.
That was Health Equity Matters CEO Dash Heath Painter.
Pacific Beat.
Staying in the Solomon Islands, there is a political controversy brewing over the appointment of political appointees within the Prime Minister's office. A leaked list showing 58 appointees, including one social media influencer, has sparked a public backlash. Questions have been raised about whether the $21 million price tag for these appointments matches the experience of the appointees. But Is this an isolated situation, or is it something experienced by previous governments? Joining us this morning to chat more about this is Pacific and Solomons political expert, Dr. Terence Wood from the Australian National University. Dr. Terence Wood, welcome to Pacific Beat.
Hey, good morning.
So nice to have you here. Now, let's get right into it. Doctor, to start off, what is a political appointee and how do they find it fit into the government system in the Solomon Islands?
Well, they, in theory, they should fit by providing advice either upwards to the Prime Minister or downwards, I guess, to the government departments or relevant ministers who might form in the government, who might sit in the government.
Well, this is a very interesting scenario, but in your opinion, are political appointees necessary given that there are regular public servants within the Prime Minister's office?
Yeah, I mean, they're not uncommon, right? You do see them in other countries. And I think, I'm sort of not endorsing them necessarily, but I think you find that Prime Ministers will typically feel like it is very helpful to have appointees who they may be able to pick directly and who they may know and who they may feel more confident in than would be the case with heads of government departments who have typically been in situ for quite a long time.
Now, but Doctor, why has Matthew Wallace's political appointments generated so much controversy over there? In the Solomon Islands?
So my understanding is that he's appointed quite a few people, at least in comparison to what previous prime ministers have done. And also some of the people are perhaps a little unusual in the sense that some of them come from sort of unusual backgrounds, like, as you said, social media influencers and the like, or people who haven't been in the political system or been playing the political game for a long period of time.
Yes, you did mention that the previous government has also appointed similar situation under Jeremiah Manele, which had around 40 political appointees. Now, Matthew Wallace has appointed 58 and possibly maybe more. Do you think that there can be a justification for such a large number of PAs?
It's sort of all about trade-offs, right? So you appoint more people, well, obviously the costs of those people or the overall cost of those people to the government increases. However, in the big scheme of things, compared to sort of the overall level of government spending, appointees like this don't amount to being a particularly large cost. And you might, I mean, I think the claim that would be put forward is that we live in a changing world, and we have a new government driven by a man who I think would like to change things. And so under those circumstances, it might well be justified to have more people that ought to add to your knowledge base and provide you with more advice. And the view might be, and the Prime Minister's view might be, that he needs the additional expertise and insights to run the country in the best possible way.
Dr. Wood, you know, the world is changing nowadays with our political system. One thing that's different is that a number of these political appointees are young and have less political experience. How important is it to have experience when you're trying to make a change?
Well, you can look at this two ways, or I guess you might say there is going to be a trade-off potentially. Obviously, expertise has its value. People who have been around for a long time may better understand the nature of the jobs they're performing. On the other hand, people with less expertise, at least within the system, might also bring useful insights in the changing world. And also you might find that they've got a bit more get up and go. This is a new government led by someone who wants to be a reformer, and having people who just have a bit more oomph, perhaps who are fresh to the system, might in theory help drive his agenda in a changing world. Ultimately, it's going to really come down to the nature of the people who he's appointed.
Yeah, speaking of the people, from the public's perspective, do you think that people will ever be satisfied about the number of political appointees, whether more or less in the future?
Ultimately, my guess is the thing that will matter most to Solomon Islanders is whether the government is seen to be functioning well. And if they find the quality of their lives improving, then I guess you'll find that they'll be satisfied. Probably one other thing to point out is there may end up being more of a furor in you know, sort of social media and what have you, but that might not necessarily be the case for the average Solomon Islander, who isn't going to be as connected to social media and who will primarily be focused on how they see their lives changing or not failing to change.
Well, Dr. Terence Woods, thank you very much for your time and your input here on Pacific Beat. Really appreciate this, your expertise and also your knowledge in sharing with the program this morning. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Yeah, thank you for the chance to speak.
You're welcome. That was Dr. Terence Wood from the Australian National University.
Hold the front page!
It's time for News Wrap here, where we'll take a look at the big stories, but staying here in Tonga. And who better than to help with our News Wrap than Popua Aho from the Tonga Broadcasting Corporation. Malolele Popua, how did you get in this morning?
Morning, Marianne, and thank you for having me again on the show. Pretty cold morning to start, but yeah, happy to be here.
Yes, cold for Tonga is 15 degrees, so yeah, it is pretty cold. Well, it's still cold out there somewhere, but let's get right into it, Popua. First to politics. By-elections are now set for October, but we could see some new faces in cabinet much sooner. Can you explain us about that?
Yes, Marianne. So the Electoral Commission has confirmed voters in Tongatapu 2 and Niue 17 will return to the polls on October 8th. So both seats became vacant after their former MPs were unseated following election court cases, one involving indirect bribery over the distribution of fish and the other involving campaign spending above the legal limit. Nominations open on September 2nd and close the following day, so it's a very short nomination window. But before those by-elections, we're expecting some movement inside government as well. There's growing discussions around a cabinet reshuffle, which could be announced very soon. Prime Minister Lord Fanua is currently acting across several portfolios, including finance, tourism, and infrastructure. So the interesting question now is who gets those jobs and whether the Prime Minister reshuffles his existing team or brings in new cabinet members. Either way, we may see changes around the cabinet table well before voters choose the two new MPs in October.
Very, very interesting. The new Prime Minister Fafanua hasn't even completed his 1 year in office and now he's reshuffling his cabinet members now. Staying with the Prime Minister, and there's also been quite a public fight between the Prime Minister's office and a local radio station. Now, what's happening there?
Yes, so this has become quite a heated debate here in Tonga. The Prime Minister's office says the broadcaster aired what it describes as false and misleading allegations targeting the Prime Minister, cabinet and government. So there are also concerns also over references to the King and members of the royal family in some of the political commentary. So the Prime Minister's office says the broadcasts have been documented and are now being considered through appropriate legal and regulatory channels. But the broadcaster isn't backing down. So it says it's received a warning from the Communications Commission about the possible suspension or cancellation of its licenses due to these allegations. And that's where this becomes a wider media freedom issue. Mm-hmm. So on one side, there are concerns that regulatory action against a broadcaster could have a chilling effect on the media. And on the other, media freedom doesn't remove a broadcaster's responsibility to ensure serious allegations are accurate and can be supported by evidence. So the key thing now is what the regulatory process finds and whether any action taken is transparent and follows proper legal process.
Now, Popua, Tonga doesn't have a bridge, but there is one in the making. Tonga's long-awaited Whangaata Bridge project is facing more delays than ever. What's holding it up?
Yes, so, well, one of the land or one of the biggest issues, rather, is the land. So there are still outstanding matters involving properties around the land, and Prime Minister Lord Fofanua has been meeting directly with some of these affected landowners, and he says one of the issue with the land has been resolved, one of them, but there are a few. So discussions are continuing over other affected properties. And land isn't the only problem. There are also issues around the contractor, with government now looking for a new project manager to handle the entire project. Mm. It's a significant project because the bridge would connect Nuku'alofa and the eastern district across the Whanga'uta Lagoon. So for people in eastern Tongatapu, that could mean shorter trips into Nuku'alofa, less congestion on the existing roads, and importantly, another evacuation route during a natural disaster. So there's a lot riding on this project, but for now, there are still some major hurdles to clear before construction can properly move ahead.
Well, I can't wait to actually have a bridge here in Tonga.
Yes, I am so looking forward to when that bridge finally comes to fruition. Also, did you notice I saw this thing online about a seal being found in one of the outer islands? Do you know anything about this?
Yes, I saw someone from the Ha'apai group out in the northern side of Tonga posted a video of a wild seal, a very young wild seal. And I just couldn't believe it. So I wanted to make sure that it's not AI.
Right.
So I put on my investigation hat and start calling people that was actually commenting on the post. And I found the family who found them. So apparently the wife of the fisherman that found the little young seal said that the husband was out fishing and it saw a little animal. This is how she described it. She saw a little animal standing at the beach at one of the smaller islands where they were fishing. Because they didn't know what it is, they got the little seal, they captured the little seal, they tied its legs and threw them into the boat, bringing the little seal home, and the seal, they have no idea what it is. Obviously, this is a very remote island here in Tonga, and obviously we don't have seal here in Tonga. So because they want to find out what it actually is, this little animal, they posted up on Facebook asking people to comment on what it is. They did receive a lot of comments from Tongan all over the world saying that's a wild seal and this is what they eat, small fishes, and, you know, describing everything. So speaking to the fisherman's family last night, I asked them, so what are you going to do with it? And they said they're going to keep it as long as they can, because apparently they feel sorry for the seal. You know, it's just a baby seal after learning so much about it. So after the show, I'll be talking to them again, and hopefully soon we'll have some more videos and pictures from the remote islands of Ha'apai here on our ABC Pacific page. So that's something to look forward to. That's very exciting. I mean, seal in Tonga, how cool is that?
It's really unusual, so it's very interesting to see.
Yes, so we have always had whales, but I'm pretty sure this seal, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure this seal came through, whatchamacallit, was piggybacking on whales to Tonga. That's the only factors that I think that it got here to Tonga. It was so far away. But yes, thank you very much, Bua, for the news wrap for today. And see you next Friday.
Nisian Footy Friday. Join Sam and Tini Rao every Friday as they dive into the weekend's footy action and have plenty of laughs along the way, with insights from NRLW powerhouse Sala Tongatuki and Fiji Rugby Union icon Namani Kurundrani. You'll get the inside scoop on Pacifica talent making waves in both rugby league and union. Nisian Footy Fridays at 1 p.m. PNG time and again at 4 on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, Michael Chow, jump in. We're late for work.
Jake McQuire, whose car is this? So flash. It's even got digital radio.
Hey, what can I say? Your boy's doing all right.
ABC Radio Australia.
Is that ABC Radio Australia on digital radio?
My guy, I forgot to tell you. We're now broadcasting Pacific voices, stories, and music right across Australia in your car, at home, wherever there's DAB+.
So my auntie in Brisbane can finally stop asking me for streaming instructions?
Exactly. Just tell her to find ABC Radio Australia on digital radio. It's that easy.
You're listening to Pacific Beat.
on ABC Radio Australia.
The story up to now from 2026 OFC Championship League in Fiji has perennial winners Auckland City and Vanuatu's Galaxy FC already through to the semi-finals. Host club Rewa FC are still in the mix, along with PNG's Lai City, as are New Caledonia's Tiga Sports and Central Coast from the Solomon Islands. But there's no doubt about which player has been the star of the show so far. Galaxy's Brazilian number 9.
Nicely waited, Medina! It is good! And there is the equalizer! We are locked at 1-0! Second goal here for Medina. Fantastic finish. His fifth goal of the tournament. He is absolutely on fire. Medina again with another opportunity. It's in! Second hat-trick for Medina. It's the William Dos Santos Medina show. And we're just lucky to be witnessing it all here in Bar.
Yes, and the lucky person calling the action there was OFC and FIFA Plus commentator Asinate Wainikolo, who joins us now from Fiji. Bula Asinate, sorry, I'm just so excited talking to you.
Bula Vinaka, Marie. It's great to join you this morning.
Yes, it's very, very, very rare to have a female calling the action there, especially with FIFA, you know, and everything that's happening. And I myself, Marianne Kupu, is a big fan of commentators, but this one will take the cup for me. So let's get right into it, Asinate. Medina has really set this tournament alight. Just how good do you think the Brazilian player is?
Oh, he's been absolutely sensational. I mean, 6 goals in 2 rounds of matches. He's, you know, practically dominated for the Galaxy FC from Vanuatu. And, you know, just also picked up his second player of the match award. And there was no doubting that as well. But he certainly set this tournament alight. And it's been great to see the partnership with the other Brazilian in the Galaxy FC side, who's also their captain, Robinson Ribeiro. And that South American flavor that they've brought into this Galaxy FC side has certainly set them alight for this championship.
Asinate, how would you assess Medina's impact on the rest of the Galaxy team?
Oh, he certainly lifted Galaxy. I mean, they also have a legend in the game in Bartram Suri, the Solomon Islander, who of course has represented the Solomon Islands and has been so prominent in Oceania football over the years. He's been coaching this Galaxy FC side. But, you know, I would say that William Dos Santos Medina, as well as the captain Ribeiro, the two Brazilians in this Galaxy FC side, have certainly lifted the performance of this team. Well, when you consider this is, you know, only their third tournament, they've returned to the competition after 4 years, but they're doing amazing work.
From your perspective, of the 4 teams still in contention, which 2 do you think are most likely to join the Galaxy in Auckland in the semifinals?
Yeah, well, it's going to be an interesting showdown in the last round of matches. We're certainly looking forward to that. And of course, on Saturday, it'll be Rewa FC that take on Lay City FC to decide who will join Galaxy FC in the semi-finals. Rewa will have plenty of support here in Fiji. But of course, Lay City FC, they've brought in a lot of the young PNG age group players that have come in to support and sort of just help with the team as well. They've been fantastic as well in this competition. Rewa FC with the home support and, you know, they'll be really looking to seal their place. I'm thinking that Rewa could possibly take this match over Lay City FC, but, you know, you never know what will happen on the day.
Yes, you never know. But, you know, and time for some crystal ball gazing, because obviously we'll never know. But will it be 5 titles in a row for Auckland in the end, or could Galaxy and Medina break the New Zealanders' strange hold?
Yeah, it's been interesting. Auckland FC, you know, are 13-time champions, but they were trailing for the most part against the Central Coast FC another team that's doing very well in this competition from the Solomon Islands, with many of their players that have featured for Solomon Kings in the OFC Pro League. They just managed to scrape past them in the last 15 to 20 minutes, 2-1 after they were trailing by a goal in the first half. And they just beat AS Tiga as well from New Caledonia by 1-0 yesterday. So it's been pretty close as well as far as competition for Auckland City FC. But I wouldn't rule out Central Coast FC, who are also contenders from Group A. And they will, of course, meet AS Tiga or Sport of New Caledonia to also decide who will go up from the semi-finals from Group A. So that's another match to look forward to over the weekend.
Asinate, when you go, I want to be like you when I grow up, you know, having to commentate, you know, all through this great sport. But thank you very much for your time. And we will be also following you in the next few games to come. Thank you very much for your time in joining Pacific Beat.
Thank you so much.
That was Asinate Wainikolo on the line from Fiji, and you can catch her calling the Champions League action over the weekend on FIFA, with all the matches being streamed live and free.
Yo, Michael Chow, jump in. We're late for work.
Jacob Quiet, whose car is this? So flashy. It's even got digital radio.
Hey, what can I say? Your boy's doing all right.
ABC Radio Australia.
Is that ABC Radio Australia on digital radio?
My guy, I forgot to tell you, we're now broadcasting Pacific voices, stories and music right across Australia, in your car, at home, wherever there's DAB+.
So my auntie in Brisbane can finally stop asking me for streaming instructions?
Exactly. Just tell her to find ABC Radio Australia on digital radio. It's that easy.
Yo, Michael Chow, jump in. We're late for work.
Jacob Quiet, whose car is this? So flashy. It's even got digital radio.
Hey, what can I say? Your boy's doing all right.
ABC Radio Australia.
Is that ABC Radio Australia on digital radio?
My guy, I forgot to tell you, we're now broadcasting Pacific voices, stories and music right across Australia, in your car, at home, wherever there's DAB+.
So my auntie in Brisbane can finally stop asking me for streaming instructions?
Exactly. Just tell her to find ABC Radio Australia on digital radio. It's that easy.
There are only 10 Polynesian Pearl Master navigators in the world, and Cook Islander Bea Patai is one of them. He is currently in Australia for the premiere of a new documentary, Waka Moana, that focuses on Bea and his 32-year passion of navigating the oceans, not just across the Pacific, but around the world. The film will showcase at the Melbourne International Film Festival. Our reporter, Eki Dubo, got to sit down with Bea for a chat ahead of the film festival this weekend.
I'm always been a fisherman since I've been small anyway. So my father was a fisherman, and the whole family really relied on fishing. The opportunity came in 1991 for me to study and learn this lost knowledge. I went to Hawaii and studied under my teacher, Naino Thompson. From then on, it just grew, still continuing to do today, and created my own canoe organization. And teaching the young ones is the main focus.
What is it that you love so much about navigating, the wayfinding, fishing, being in the ocean?
Just being on the ocean itself, it calms me down. I cannot sit on land too much. This is truth. I get frustrated. If I'm not sailing, I'll be fishing. The thing that got me is because it's a lost knowledge, and being one of those ones to revive it, and that pushed me hard, making sure that knowledge doesn't disappear anymore.
Well, that's the thing, when having your own father pass that knowledge on to you, what was some of that knowledge that he passed on?
Navigation wasn't really comes from my family, but the knowledge in the Cook Islands was totally gone. We love to tell stories about it and praise ourselves that we are famous sailors, but we don't actually do it. This knowledge was actually passed on by a grandmaster navigator from the island of Sotawala in Micronesia. Unselfishly, he passed that on to my teacher, Naino Thompson. He always says that the knowledge is for you not to keep, but to teach. Because the knowledge is sacred, just through your family line. And it got to a stage, maybe there wasn't any more sailing, then the knowledge died with it. So we made an understanding that there's no more restrictions. So it doesn't matter who you are, where you come from, we teach you. Because this is us. It's the only way us Pacific Islanders knows who we are and where we come from. Because all our stories all involve canoe sailing, traditional sailing.
What's something that sort of stands out to you on a mission that you've gone and done?
I've done a lot, and I've sailed actually right to the west coast of America, up to Mexico and Galapagos and back. But for me, actually, I just came back from the Northern Islands of the Cooks. There's a lot of water to cover. That's actually touched me a lot. Actually, going and see my people, that's really a highlight in my voyaging.
Has it been easy to pass that knowledge on? Like, have there challenges along the way?
Very challenging, especially with our young kids today. The influences of modernization is difficult. In those days, during my time, you don't listen, you get pulled on the ear. You can't do that no more. It's hard to convince our young ones to do something that is theirs, but with a hope at the end. So my job is just to keep on teaching and not get frustrated. We are about to teach the tropical kids. These are kids that are in probations, and maybe I can change some of them.
Now, you've been coined as a pro master navigator. I mean, what is the difference from that to just someone who's just a everyday fisherman? Who, so I believe, is there like only 10 of you, 10 navigators that exist as of today?
I don't praise myself too much. It's just, even those fishermen are masters in their own right. In what we do is continue to sail traditionally using no modern equipments, just using the stars, the suns, the swells and those sort of things.
Yes, let me quickly go there. I want to ask you, Bia, when you're looking at the stars at night, what is it that you're specifically looking for if you're trying to navigate to maybe to another island?
There's patterns of stars in the sky, and on a nice night, that's you never lose any because the latitude changes. Mm. It's when the star rises. You look around you in the horizons, that's your compass. That's your life compass, and you're sitting right in the middle, and you move your canoe around the compass, and these stars are your guidance that marks you, and then gives you, okay, this is the right time, the right way to go. You know exactly Southern Cross basically points south. That's a clear mark if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, and if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, Northern Star sits right at North Celestial Pole and doesn't move. That's an awesome position for you to navigate by. It's just 1995 when we first sailed. There wasn't any requirements like that. We went to Hawaii with no life checkers, no requirements at all. You know, things change. For us to continue doing that, we have to comply with the modern requirements for safety.
Would that have been like your travels that you had done in regards to the FESPAC in Hawaii? How was that expedition?
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, the first time the canoe actually left from the Cooks direct to Hawaii. We did that, you know, because we wanted to. I appreciate it because my crew that I took was all my young students. And it gives them that reality that it's not just easy voyage all the time. So, you know, and it took us 23 days.
And of course, after years of yourself being at the helm, you are at the center of this documentary called Waka Moana. I mean, what has that been like to be able to tell your story, tell the stories of forefathers who have gone before you?
I'm so happy that there is a couple of traditional knowledge that actually focus in this film. The traditional navigations and also the traditional knowledge of food preservations, the Rawi system. And I do have, and I think each island in the Pacific have their own system of looking after their own kai. So with this system, they block certain areas so that it allows fish to recover. You know, our ancestors are so smart. They do things for their survival, basically. And I always keep on saying that's our generation's the one that muck everything up. So let's fix it up again.
So ancestors of the future, what do you think that title itself implies to the viewers who are going to be coming through to watch the documentary?
Yeah, I think it was the right title. And we'll see how the effects or how our ancestors have been doing things. Yeah.
To those who would be interested, who would want to maybe become a navigator one day, what do you say to the younger generation?
I'm actually starting a school. I'm building a school on the island of Aitutaki.
Wow.
And this focus on traditional knowledge, where I teach traditional navigations and traditional canoeing and other knowledges that goes with it, food preservation, songs, and everything. So we're looking at probably in 2 years' time that will be very active.
That was Cook Island Pearl Master Navigator Pia Patai speaking there to Aggie Dubol. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat on this Friday. Time to take a look back at our main stories today. Vanuatu's president is refusing to bow to public pressure and revoke the pardons he granted to two men convicted of sexually abusing children. And Australia has announced an $8 million package to help tackle Fiji's HIV crisis.
Managing a very infectious disease such as HIV requires enormous resourcing and enormous technical and strategic investment.
Pacific Beat will be back next week, Monday morning at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia through Because News is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daily. I was your host today, Marianne Kupu from Nukalofa, the capital of the Kingdom of Tonga. I hope everything goes well and you'll be listening from me here from Tonga next Friday here on Pacific Beat. Marianne Kupu signing out.